America and its ongoing relationship with China, today on UK Perspectives. I'm Chase Kavanaugh. Ever since ping-pong diplomacy and President Nixon's historic visit, the United States has developed an enduring political, economic, and cultural relationship with the People's Republic of China. This relationship has faced challenges in recent years with trade imbalances, China's rise as a regional power, and human rights concerns. With me to provide a first-hand view of this relationship and other issues is Ambassador to China, Governor of Utah, and presidential candidate John Huntsman Jr. Welcome to UK Perspectives.
Hey, thanks, Chase. Good to be with you.
Ambassador Huntsman, you've had a fascinating professional life that has taken you from Salt Lake City to Singapore and from the Office of the Trade Representative to handling diplomatic relations with our biggest trading partner. What do you feel is the greatest challenge facing U.S.-China relations today?
Well, I think the largest challenge facing us right now is being able to put the U.S.-China relationship in proper context, where we can see it both as a rising power, one that carries with it some real challenges, challenges that we can rise to and solve, but also some enormous opportunities in the way of export opportunities, trade and investing opportunities, and cultural opportunities for the younger generation to connect with the people of a country that will be the most important relationship of the 21st century. So it's a mixed bag in terms of being able to disaggregate what today is a very complicated relationship in the minds of most Americans, one that is sometimes seen through the prism of fear and sometimes seen through the prism of opportunity. Those challenges are only going to get more acute as we bump up against each other on the world stage, as the Pacific Ocean becomes smaller and smaller with the two largest militaries in the world, those of the United States and China, and certainly the two largest economies on the face of the earth, the United States and China. So there is a lot on which we should be collaborating, and there's a lot on which we'll be competing. So it's one of those things where we're going to have to do a fairly regular situation where we're going to have to balance our interests constantly, whether they're economic or whether they're security. It will never be a black or white relationship, but rather always one where we're going to have to figure out how best to protect and defend America's interests.
You mentioned contextualization of the relationship. What do you think would be a good way to bring that message forward? Like you said, try to get the relationship more understandable to the American people.
Well, the more interaction you have with another country, the better off you're going to be longer term in your ability to understand history, traditions, culture, differing political systems. So when you look at both of our countries, you couldn't have two countries that are more different in the way we see the world. You look at history. China's the oldest civilization, arguably, in the world with 5,000 continuous years of civilization. We're a very young democracy by comparison. They have a one-party state. We have the longest surviving constitution in the world that still serves our people well. We have a relatively small population with 325 million people. They have the largest in the world with 1.3 billion people. They're surrounded by 14 different nation states in a much different neighborhood than ours, where we've got Canada to the north and, of course, Mexico to the south. The role of the individual is seen as completely different, depending upon which side of the Pacific you're on. We see the individual through certain Jeffersonian freedoms and liberties, where the individual reigns supreme. In China, the collective is always put before the individual. There's a Confucius tradition as opposed to a Jeffersonian tradition. So how do you bridge these enormous differences? Well, the only way that you begin to bridge them is by having more in the way of opportunities back and forth to better understand one another. We'll disagree on things. That doesn't mean you need to have a relationship based on conflict. You need to better understand the basis on which we arrive at certain decisions and the way we see the world. So today, China has probably 200,000 students studying in our colleges and universities, the largest exporter of students, if you will, of any country in the world. They just overtook India recently. And we have a much smaller number of kids who are studying in China. But then when you look at the schools throughout the United States, I was governor in one state where we started a Mandarin language program in our public schools. What does that do? It gives kids at a very early age an opportunity to learn a language and through language begin to better understand culture in a part of the world that otherwise would be very foreign. So I look at it this way, Chase. The emerging generation, the millennials, will have a whole lot more in the way of opportunities by way of travel, communication, cultural exchanges, academic and educational opportunities, far more than any generation before them, which means that there will be a lot more in the way of opportunities back and forth to better understand each country and to therefore manage our interests and our differences without any kind of conflict or hostility breaking out.
On the subject of hostility, a major news item has been China's escalation of territorial claims. With America's treaty commitments and the concerns of our allies in the region, what do you think is the best way to go forward?
Well, it's a highly complicated set of geographic, political, and historic challenges that play out by way of sovereignty in both the East China Sea and the South China Sea. First and foremost, we do have commitments to our allies, and that should be our first order of business. How do we deal with the security issues that confront our friends and allies like Korea, like Japan, like Philippines, just to mention some in East Asia and Southeast Asia? And then the second order of business should be, what do we do to maintain free passage for commerce and for trade, which is good for everybody? And we've always been committed to that, particularly in the post-World War II period. But we have provided an insurance policy in the Asia-Pacific region through that very sensitive body of water that has ensured the flow of commerce and therefore economic prosperity, not only in Asia, but also here in the United States. So that needs to be part of it as well. Third, we need to recognize that there is no easy answer when you look at sovereignty claims, particularly some that go back maybe as far as 1895. Japan has them, Korea has them, Philippines has them, China has them, Taiwan has them. And you're not going to arrive at an easy answer that just all of a sudden settles it. Therefore, the question becomes, how do you manage the tensions going forward? How do you manage the differing disputes? How do you manage the legal and historic interpretations of these islands? And how do you manage them in a way that prevents war and conflict? And in that, the United States certainly has a role to play as an honest broker. And that certainly should be what we do going forward. We've done that in the past. And if we play our cards right, that's the role that we'll play going forward as well.
Since China's leadership changes infrequently, what do you believe we can expect from new President Xi Jinping?
Well, we will expect the rise, as we have seen over the last year, of the fifth generation of leaders. We've had Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, and now we're in the fifth generation with Xi Jinping. The generation that is now taking over, they're well-educated, well-traveled, unlike earlier generations. They've been around. They understand economic development, investment. They understand the challenges that lie before them in China, which are enormous, by the way. Whether you look at jobs and employment or whether you look at things like air quality in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, these are big, big issues and challenges that aren't easily resolved. So he will now set his sights on what will need to be done in order to keep China a stable, prosperous, growing country. And that will require some major reform steps that won't happen quickly, because you just can't reform a nation as big and complicated as China quickly without things coming undone. So I suspect that we'll see some reform around things like state-owned enterprises. We'll see reform around greater recognition of what rule of law means in terms of trade, investment, economic development generally. We'll see some reforms around a shifting population, which is going from the rural areas of the country more and more into the city centers, putting stresses and strains on cities that are already among the biggest in the world. And we'll likely see reforms around things like social safety net issues, retirement, social security, healthcare, particularly in the rural parts of the country. All of these are enormously complicated and carry with them very, very high costs that China, particularly in today's environment, with the increasing debt loads that it is carrying, particularly at the local government levels, will be a real challenge for them going forward. But those are some of the issues that I suspect we'll see Xi Jinping really focused on in the years to come.
Bringing it all back together, what do you feel should be the U.S.'s top priorities with China going forward?
Well, I think our priorities will be a combination of, one, economic priorities, because as China continues to grow at 7%, maybe 7.5%, even if it fell down to 6%. 6% or 7% growth today, while the Chinese may say it is slowing down, is still a whole lot bigger than 7% growth just a few short years ago in China. So their economy continues to expand. And with it, the purchasing power of their new middle class, which will emerge as the largest purchasing population the world has ever seen. And with that, more and more in the way of export opportunities for our manufacturers here in the United States. Our services, our manufacturing, our ingenuity and know-how will have more opportunities with that marketplace than ever before. So there's an economic dimension that should be first and foremost on our list of things to get done with China. And second, really has to do with the overall security of the Asia-Pacific region, because without the United States and China working on basic security-related issues, nobody else can step up to the plate. And you have a world that becomes a little wobbly without the U.S. and China collaborating. And I speak specifically of things like North Korea and creating more of a denuclearized zone on the Korean Peninsula, which ultimately should be the outcome that we work toward. Things like Afghanistan post-2014, when all American troops are out, that becomes a major problem in Southwest Asia, not just for China, which is a border state, but for about four other nuclear-powered countries in South Asia and beyond, all of whom are going to be competing for territory. These are large and complicated and very sensitive issues that China will increasingly have to step up to and help to resolve. And there's no way that you can find resolution without both the U.S. and China working together. So that will be a whole other box of issues, aside from just the economic trade and investment issues that the United States really will want to focus on in the years ahead.
They used to say that politics stops at the water's edge, but it seems today like our two national parties can't agree on anything. How did this lack of bipartisanship affect your ability to advance American interests abroad?
Well, it is true that foreign policy, national security policy, really has become politicized, which is unfortunate. I grew up in a world in which Republicans and Democrats came together around our position abroad, whether they were wars, whether they were economic opportunities, whether they were figuring out how to deal with third-party conflict. And I think increasingly that's when America is at her best. You know, we argue, we debate the issues, we figure out the best possible way forward. But when it comes to the sensitive issues abroad, America should figure out a better way to speak with a single voice about our interests. Because countries abroad, when they see that we are divided at home, will try to take advantage of that division. But it also sends, I think, a less than helpful message to countries that want to become more like the United States in how we handle civil society, how we handle individuals, our system of law and order, our constitutional government. There are a lot of countries around the world that still very much envy the way in which we do business and want to become more like us. As we are divided abroad and on foreign policy and national security issues, it unfortunately sends a message to many in the world that maybe we are not the model that was once envied, that many would like to be like, because they remember a country that worked well, where Americans came together as Americans at the end of the day, not as partisan party hacks, but as members of a nation state that stood for rule of law, that stood for democracy, that stood for freedom and liberty. And those messages are still watched and followed very, very carefully by people on the other side of the world. I know that, having lived overseas four different times.
Finally, I can't let you go without asking, any plans for 2016?
Well, the only plans are to be part of the mix of ideas and finding solutions for our country going forward. Sometimes I think there is way too much in the way of politics and too little in the way of putting forward solutions and big picture ideas that will actually help us. And I want to be part of finding fixes and solutions and a way in which Republicans and Democrats can actually come together in the name of problem solving. I'm way more interested in that as opposed to just politics.
Thank you. Our guest has been John Huntsman, Jr. For WUKY, I'm Chase Cavanaugh.